Hey, it's Tom here, and welcome back to another episode of the Investing with Tom podcast. Now, on this one, I speak to a couple out of Australia who are returning guests. It's Mitch and Cass Dole. I had them on the podcast back in May, and they had kind of recently come off the back of making quite a significant, you know, very successful macro call in 2020 when we recorded that first episode. They saw the COVID-19 pandemic, the coronavirus, coming very early. Ended up liquidating quite a lot of their portfolio, I think actually all of their portfolio, and putting a small slither of the portfolio into basically put options on travel companies, which, as you can imagine, ended up working out very well. And they had a great year in 2020. And on that podcast, we sort of talked through how traditionally Mitch and Cass are sort of bottom-up stock pickers, value investors, you know, focused on individual businesses. But from time to time, they do see these really significant macro events kind of come up, and they sort of viewed the COVID pick and the put options they put in place as sort of a one-off. And, you know, fast forward to December 2021, as really recorded this episode, they've actually made an interesting new hedge in their portfolio around inflation. So that is really a lot of the sort of talking points of this particular episode. Mitch and Cass are more than willing to admit that they may be wrong on this. And I think it's important to sort of do your own research on this topic. But nonetheless, there's clearly some very big headline numbers coming out of the US in particular on CPI and high inflation rates and so on. So I think it is a really interesting and important topic to discuss. So that's the little disclaimer before we get into that of course, do your own research. And this is for entertainment purposes only, as always. So with all that said, let's roll the episode with Mitch and Cass, and I hope you enjoy. Mitch and Cass, back on the podcast. How you guys been doing?
Good. Thanks, mate, for having us back on. Second time round. Yeah, I feel, buddy, privileged.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah, this should be fun. I was just looking up before we jumped on this call, and it looks like you guys were back on the podcast in May, and had a pretty crazy kind of 12 months or so leading up to that point, obviously, with the big sort of macro call around COVID, basically. Yeah. So it was interesting to kind of get the story of how that all played out. And you've been making some other interesting hedges recently, which, you know, you're thinking might play out in future. So it'd be good to kind of get you on here before the fact, hopefully.
Hopefully
it plays out just as well as COVID. How cool would that be?
Oh yeah, it'd be good to have two of those. That'd be quite good.
Yeah, that's like I've been watching The Big Short the last couple of days, and the first time I talked to you guys, it reminded me exactly of that movie. So we'll see if we can get some content that maybe gets featured in The Big Short 2 or something.
Sure. I like how you're aiming so low with the podcast, Tom. It's like we'll just create something that they'll want to make The Big Short 2.
I'm sure we're just as smart as Mike Burrow.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're easy boots to fill. We'll be fine.
That guy's a genius. But ironically, some of this stuff actually started with Mike Burry that started us down this path. So
that's true.
Yeah. There is a bit of a link there.
Yeah.
100%. Well, maybe for those people that might not have caught the first episode that you guys were on, did you want to give us a brief refresher on maybe your background and kind of getting into investing and your situation at the moment being full-time investors?
Correct. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I guess basically I'm a carpenter by trade, and I always say I wasn't a very good one. I was a decent carpenter. But when I finished my apprenticeship, I've always gravitated towards statistics, and I always loved cricket stats and data and trying to use that to make decisions. And my first job out of my apprenticeship was as a school groundskeeper. So I was sitting there bored all day out of my brains, you know, trying to work out what to do with, you know, my life. Just came across a video about Warren Buffett. And I've always been attracted to investing, but yeah, obviously something about his approach just resonated with me. And I've heard a lot of value investors say that when they first hear Buffett, they kind of feel it resonate within themselves, that it's, this makes sense, and I'm the kind of person that can do that. So that was when we were kind of at, you know, zero net worth, starting from scratch. And then over the next few years, we saved a bit of money. I got a bit of a better job. Cass got a bit of a better job, and we're able to buy a house. So then we bought a house. We've used our skills. Cass worked in real estate for quite a few years. So we used our skills to renovate that house and then to sell it. We made a bit of money from that, which was good. And by that point, I was getting really, really passionate about investing. You know, I think I'd read like maybe like 30 or 40 books up to that point. I was just chewing through all this information. So, you know, and I've been doing okay investing. I think the compounding rate was like mid-teens, 15% a year for about 3 years. So we made the kind of big decision, which we seem to keep doing, is we keep to be making these big bets on ourselves, I guess, where we sold the house, took the money, and then we actually rented a pretty crappy little place. And I started, you know, trying to compound our money. And you were always okay with it, pretty much. Cass is always happy for me to just follow my passion, which was amazing.
Well, it's kind of like if someone spends like hundreds of hours reading about something, well, they can't do too badly, right? It's
yeah,
like,
yeah.
I'm happy to take that bet. Let's give it a try.
Exactly. Cass's investment was in me, which was good. So you're very concentrated. You should watch
good
that.
Good pick, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to diversify a little bit.
Hopefully not. So, yeah, basically, you know, that's sort of 4 years ago, thereabouts. We've got, you know, a good amount of capital there that I'm trying to compound. I started value investing. I was buying stocks at discount to book value and trying to, you know, have little positions and all that kind of thing. And then we decided that was going okay. Again, I haven't had any massive investing success. It just kind of slow compounding over the years. And then we decided that we'd like to live in a tiny house. So we...
Well, yeah, I think because I started to like want to do stuff with my life as well, because like I just worked, got straight out of high school, straight into real estate basically, and just worked for 10 years without thinking. And you kind of like get stuck in this
loop.
Like loop of doing the exact same thing every single day. And you kind of get brain numbed in a way, and you stop thinking, stop learning, stop like trying to do different things. And so, yeah, I was like, you know, if we cut our costs right back, I might actually feel free enough give some other things a go.
Yeah.
But like while you have like a mortgage payment or rent and like normal costs that eat away like 60% to 80% of your wage, like you're not really, you don't have that freedom to try something different with your time, and you don't have the time even to do that. So.
And there's only so much risk we can take, you know, I think emotionally, like you sort of, if you're really risking it with your capital, then it's, you want to have your base costs very stable, very reliable, so you can actually think logically. So you're not actually having to need things to work out. So you can take these bets and these investments that may take 3 or 4 years to work out. So yeah, again, we're at a little rental. We had our capital. We built a tiny house on the weekends. So
a year of Saturdays.
A year of Saturdays. Nice. Building a house that where we could live in Cass's family's backyard.
Yeah, and we lived there for 2 years.
We lived there for 2 years. That's
which
true.
Is brilliant. Like we would recommend it for anybody.
Mm.
It resets what you think you need to live and like
what
you need to be happy.
Yeah.
It's like you can go and basically just own what your basic needs are. You know, live out of a backpack and you can be just as happy. So like experiencing that is helpful for anybody.
Yeah.
But then it's kind of like after 2 years, like you're spending all your time filtering your own water and you run out of like hot water and
changing your compost toilet every month or two, you know, it's
dealing
not,
with flies coming out of the compost toilet. Like it's not luxurious, and it's kind of like you've simplified your life, but it's just because everything you do is simple. Like everything you're doing like has been sorted out with civilization and society.
Yeah, yes.
Like you shouldn't have to be doing that. So
we were kind of
like, you know, this is good. It's been a great experiment. But we need to live in a normal house again. So
yeah.
2 years is a good innings, I think.
2 years was a good innings. And about six months into that living in the tiny house was when the virus happened. So yeah, we were just running along normal Value Investors Club every day, reading about investing, reading books. Cass at that point was starting to learn quite a lot about investing, getting really interested in it. And then, yeah, I just read an article about the virus in Wuhan. And something about that just like shocked me, just kind of jarred in my brain that this is something that would potentially be a risk no matter what I owned, no matter what kind of companies I owned. If this got really, really bad, then it would be a big factor. So we... And Cass, obviously, you agreed that this is really serious, and being quite scientifically minded, we're able to dig into the data and understand what an R number was and understand how, you know, the virus could compound and spread the world. So I'd never done this before in five or so years of investing, but yeah, we basically liquidated the whole portfolio in about 3 days. And then about 2 weeks later, as the virus continued to build in severity throughout the world, I think it was raging in Iran, it was raging in a few other countries, but the market was still not reacting at all to it. It was just going along as normal.
This is like January, February, I think.
January, February, yeah.
Really early, yeah.
And we'd done our shop for like all of our food, and we told all our families, you know, just prepare yourselves, this could be really bad. Like, we went out and bought like a CPAP machine.
We had a blood oxygen monitor as well, you know, just to check. And
so we've got full doomsday with it. And then we're like, okay, we'll liquidate the portfolio just so that money's there, you know, if something happens, at least we've got something to play with. But then we're like, well, what else could we be doing?
What else could we be doing? It seems pretty obvious now looking back, but the thing to us seemed, okay, well, I guess travel stocks are going to be, you know, impacted. No one's going to want to go overseas. There's going to be some kind of lockdown or some kind of, that's like the most logical way that the governments would approach it. We bought put options, out of the money put options, which is essentially insurance. It's like taking out insurance on a car you don't own. That's how I always explain it to people. And the good thing about in put options is you can own them for you can take out the insurance policy for like a 6 month period, even if you believe that over the next month or two, you're going to be able to find out more information about how the situation is developing. So we always knew that whatever our option position was, that we can always sell out at any point and we can always go back into the market, but just good to have that flexibility. So we ended up taking 4% of the portfolio and buying puts on Qantas and Flight Center. Eventually it got to the point where the virus was getting so bad, the market just couldn't ignore it anymore. And I think it was the first week of March when it just all collapsed, and the world, you know, there was lockdowns, people started panicking, they were trying to get, you know, toilet rolls in supermarkets and buy food. And we're so glad that we took care of the health side of it first and telling all our family and trying our best to explain to all our family how serious we thought this was. But then after that, we were fortunate to make about a 15x on that 4% of the portfolio, which pushed us forward massively in our financial journey and allowed us to, you know, Cass to quit her job and me to quit my job and to, for the next year, pretty much invest full time, which is when we spoke to you, I think.
It's a crazy story. It's like, it really does sound like a movie. Like, I'm sort of joking about the Big Short here, but
if we spoke about the intricacies of those weeks, we actually had booked a holiday. So we were up the Sunshine Coast, Queensland.
In Noosa.
And we like had no reception where we were.
Yeah.
And every night we're getting these emails through being like, okay, your option position is worth this much. And it was going from
it was swinging huge.
50% up and down like each night.
Yeah, swinging in huge directions every day, which was extremely, I wouldn't say it was super stressful because we kind of knew that, look, we're in a good position here. Like, it's going in the right direction. And we knew you're never going to be able to time it perfectly with, you know, getting out of that kind of position. We're in Noosa. We had no internet.
We're out in like the middle of nowhere with like phones in the air trying to get reception. Like, what is it worth? And the whole world's going crazy. It was a bizarre time.
And then the actual, when I actually went to sell the options, this is something I haven't spoken about before, but we were talking about the other day, is that there was actually no market to, no one was looking to buy the insurance that we had on those companies. So we actually had to exercise the put option, which involves buying the stock at the current price and then putting it to somebody else. So we had to, luckily we had the capital there, and that was actually how the trade was exercised. And this was all over the phone in a car park next to a beach in Noosa where there was internet. That was all just like,
it's just crazy. It's like, crazy. You know, just, yeah. buy stock in Qantas and Flight Centre right now to exercise your options. Like, I don't want to buy stock.
Exactly.
Like, we're stockholders overnight and we haven't sold our option position. You've got to do that later. So,
yeah. It was a real mess. And that's one of these sort of, you do something at the start thinking you're protected, but then it gets you into a situation that you have to just deal with. And
it's the best way to learn though.
But definitely. But we're very fortunate it worked out the way it did.
Yeah. And so when you did actually have to buy the stock, I guess, was it sort of lucky that it was only like a 4% position, that like you had enough capital to actually go and exercise it?
Yeah.
Because it's like a hugely leveraged bit of exposure, right?
Exactly right. I have to go back and look at the exact numbers, but yeah, you're right. From memory, it was a pretty good chunk of our capital that we had there. Mm. And that's something that we've actually been considering again this time. If we go again, make this a bigger position, which is, I guess, getting a bit further down the track into our inflation bet at the moment. But if we do get in a position where it's working out, you don't want to have it where you can't, make the trade happen.
You need liquidity.
Which is also something that, again, we watched The Big Short about 2 weeks ago as well, because, it's what you do when you're an investor. You love it. It's a great movie. And
Standard Friday night.
All right, Kath, it's Big Short time.
Yes.
And that's a situation they got into. Like, they checked everything correctly. But I think it was Steve Baum or whatever that guy's name is. They haven't used his real name. But, yeah, he ended up that he was shorting the company that he worked for. Because, the bank that owned his fund actually was the ones that were
on the other side
of the trade. So he was in a position where he was going to make great returns for his fund, but the investment bank that owned his fund might have gone under and they might have lost everything. So this is the kind of crazy things that can happen in markets.
Yeah, for sure. And so what's been happening in your world since you've since moved out of the tiny home, judging by that big bookcase behind you? I understand you've started a business as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so we kind of got to the point where the tiny house was good, but we wanted to start a business, and it had been 2 hours, two years, so we wanted some change. Basically, started to try and live somewhere a little bit nicer. So we thought, okay, well, how are we going to do that? We don't want to be chewing through too much of our NTA every year if we up our expenses. So I had this little construction services business. Basically, it's a waterproofing business. When someone renovates their bathroom, they have to do waterproofing. And we met a really, really amazing person who was very entrepreneurial and very keen to be involved in growing a little business. So we thought, okay, we're going to take Tim and add this little business that we have in kind of hibernation while we're, ignoring phone calls and just trying to focus on investing. And we're going to sort of see if we can train him and hopefully hand the business over to him. So now it's been about 4 months since that time. And the business has now gotten to the point where it's, self-sustaining, and we're making, a good, not a huge amount of money, but a good amount of money off it. And that's enabled us to move somewhere a little bit nicer, which is good.
Yeah. And it's just kind of like that is so unfamiliar to what I would usually do. Like the old me would have been like, all right, we want to move into a normal rental again and pay rent. I'm going to have to go back and get a job.
Yeah.
Like that would be my go-to strategy normally. But because I've had the chance now to read so many books and learn so much over the past 2 years, I'm like, no, you can have a strategy to create some passive income. You don't have to just use your time.
Yeah.
Like just work smarter,
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, that's the value in learning.
Yeah.
It's like that compounding effect, like what mm-hmm. can actually change in your life and the way that you think as well. You can't really put a value on it.
And you never know once you do give yourself, I guess our time for that was when we moved in the tiny house and we had no rent and we could just really just stuff around all day if we wanted to.
Totally free.
Totally free to do what we want. That's when we really start to talk about, okay, what are our base beliefs? What are our base opinions about some of these things? Do we have to work? How much we really need to survive and to sustain us? And then your brain just will come up with new ways of solving problems when you have the free time to think. Because when you're working every day, all your mental, productive energy is going on solving essentially other people's problems. Like that's what it is. You're always solving problems for your boss or for this person or for that person.
for a set hourly amount.
For a set hourly amount with no leverage. So
there's a better way, but you've got to learn about it, understand it, and then be comfortable taking a little bit of risk to live life a little bit differently.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm.
I'm hearing a few Naval lessons coming through on this conversation.
You read that book. What did you think?
I did read the book. It was great. It's sort of, I think I probably read it too quickly. Like I read it in very few sittings. And I know you said to me, I think when I first started it, like it's good in small doses because it's quite wide ranging. But there are some great ideas in there. I'm a fan now.
Yeah. I just love how simple it is.
Yeah.
Like the ideas are so true. Like you read it and like, that makes sense. You know, it's so simple, but it's crazy how many people don't apply that simplicity in their life.
Oh yeah, definitely. I think that the biggest principle would be the leverage principle, that, you know, you've got a set amount of time, you know, do you want to get paid a set amount of money for that time? Or do you want to do something that at least has the chance of kind of an exponential growth? And whether that's a book or a podcast or YouTube or, you know, using your capital to make investments in other businesses, like they all have the same kind of principle, which is that they have exponential leverage to them. So yeah.
I like it. And so what's the plan for the business side of things moving forward? Is that something that's scalable and you sort of have plans to grow, or is it a point now where you're kind of comfortable with it doing its own thing?
Compared to investing, you know, business is both easier and harder, I think, in a lot of ways. It's actually been quite illuminating to see that. Like even just growing a small business, you're competing against people who've been doing it for years. You know, you've got to really execute on things that are going to be your competitive advantage. But we still have plans to keep growing the business. It's only been 4 months and I think I'll wait to see till next year to see in like a non going towards Christmas environment, like, you know, how it's growing and how much work we have coming in and whether we can take on new lines of business. And we're always quite protective of our time too. I don't want to, you know, for a few months there, we were spending a lot of time trying to hustle and grow the business. And I was talking to builders every day and doing things and, you know, it's good, but obviously it does detract from the investing, which is the most important thing to us, that the compounding continues. So it's very easy to get distracted, but yeah, I think it has a lot of potential. Cass has got a great kind of background in business systems with her real estate business that she worked for.
I basically just try and take whatever jobs are in the business and just make it be able to be done by a computer or AI or like non-human, as much non-human touching in the business as possible is like the best strategy for anything.
and there is a lot of potential for that in tradie businesses. A lot of tradie businesses do run off, you know, just a phone call. They might have a diary, but apart from that, there's not much. And we use a computer program that we run all our jobs through. So every job is tracked and take photos. So there's a lot of potential, but who knows? We'll see how we go next year, I think.
It's at a good level it's paying what we need for our costs and it's paying what Tim needs for his costs. And it's really like when you have someone like Tim who you've brought into it, it's kind of, it's going to feed off his energy and his motivation. And he has a lot of that. So if he also gets, I mean, the plan is to give him percentage of profits.
Yeah.
So that incentive is there for him to build if he wants to.
Yeah.
But where the business is at the moment, it's just a solid level, like a good foundation for us.
Yeah.
So it's working really well.
Definitely.
But it's so valuable to be a business owner and an investor at the same time. Like it's hard. It takes a lot of time and you're pushing your energy. But to be doing that simultaneously, you just kind of intricately understand what CEOs are saying and you understand what you're reading in reports so much clearer.
Yeah.
Definitely.
It's definitely helping that way too.
Yeah,
couldn't agree more. Well, should we talk inflation?
Yes, please.
It's a can of worms, but I know you guys have been getting pretty deep into this recently. So let's just start off with what's your kind of view on inflation. I mean, it's been a pretty hot topic over the past maybe 12, 18 months in the investing world generally, but we're really just, I guess, starting to see it really show up in CPI kind of numbers. Commodities have sort of been ripping for a while, but there's probably not so many people talking about that. So what's kind of your current view on inflation generally?
So I think our current view is that is just that it's a massive, massive risk that people aren't really taking as seriously as they should. So I definitely wouldn't classify our opinion as strong or as confident as we were on the virus, but it does have similar dynamics where it's a huge issue that doesn't matter what stock you own, doesn't matter what your strategy is, you're going to be affected if this happens, and they have to raise rates. So raising rates would be the catalyst for assets to revalue. So there's a lot of room between, you know, how far are they going to let inflation run before they raise rates? You know, are elements of it transitory? You know, all of these things are just questions that most people, if they're honest, don't really have the answers to. And we don't have the answers to that either. We have our view on them. But my main view is that it is the biggest risk to all portfolios and something people should be, I guess, trying to hedge against, which we have now done.
Yeah. And I guess I've forced you to look at more macro stuff because that's, I don't know, since the COVID bet, it's kind of, I can see what an impact all these connecting economies, it's like a organic ecosystem in a way.
Yeah.
So that fascinates me. So when you look at like our current situation in the world at the moment, from a financial economic background, like it's such a unique time that we're living in.
It's like, not normal.
I don't know if like the average person is aware of it or not, but it feels like the amount of money just sloshing around,
yeah,
and the amount of bubbles just everywhere, it's crazy. It feels like a crazy time in history that we're being able to like live in the middle of, and to see how it's going to unfold is going to be really interesting.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess the way we look at it is with so much money sitting in the hands of people, especially in America, and so little goods for them to buy, but so much pent up demand.
Yeah.
It's just like a really dangerous spot for the Fed, especially to not be already controlling, they're just kind of sitting back and hoping it all fix itself.
And their job is, you know, basically to control. One of their jobs is to control price stability and employment. So that those are their two mandates. So that they're always talking about how what they do affects the market, but really their job is to help to control the real economy. In the real economy, people are like, consumer confidence is actually at a record low, despite people having gotten 5% pay rises, you know, over year. So I believe that there'll be a time that comes. I'm not sure whether it'll be in a month, whether it'll be in 6 months or a year, but there'll be a time that comes when inflation could be getting out of control. You know, it's already very, very high, but they still maintain that elements of it are transitory. They don't have to take too much action. But if it is getting out of control and people are really starting to suffer, and usually it's poor people that suffer the most because they don't have assets that are being blown up by the inflation. They're generally trying to buy food and more average day stuff, and they're the ones that get hurt the worst by this. So eventually, if the Federal Reserve is forced to come in and do what's best for the average person, then that's going to mean interest rates that are much, much higher than now if inflation is higher. And our research has basically, Larry Summers has been talking about this a lot for months, and he's been proved correct in everything he said. But yeah, there's just a lot of danger around right now. And I think it's a time to be very, very careful as an investor, because if you do get those rates jumping up, let's say the inflation rate settles around 4, you need an interest rate that's around 4 to stop the inflation getting worse. That's just basic math. And if you think about it from your own perspective, if the inflation rate in your life and everything you experience is around 5%, but your money is getting 1% in the bank, then how does your mind work? Do you want to leave that money in the bank, or do you want to push that money into the economy to protect its purchasing power? Well, you're going to want to take it out of the bank. You're going to want to spend money. And that's one of the ways that inflation can actually accelerate quickly without people realizing it, is that by leaving the rates low and by watching the inflation rate, you know, week after week, month after month, just keep ticking along, you're actually allowing, it's like walking around a pile of timber with a match, basically. You're saying, okay, well, I'm just going to, the water's over there. If it goes on fire, then I'm going to put it out. But, you know, if the fire gets away from you, then you might need a lot of water, and the lot of water can drown investors, basically,
yeah.
is the way to explain it, I think.
Way to explain it.
Yeah.
I like the analogy, yeah. And so I mean, last time when we were talking through sort of the COVID bit, I think I'm pretty sure you described that as most likely a one-off, and I guess now we're back sort of talking macro again. Yeah. So yeah. How do you think about balancing, at least as I understand, and we can maybe get into this later in the episode here, but as I understand it, still most of the portfolio is very much kind of bottoms up, just stock picking and analyzing individual businesses, right? So how do you balance that versus when these sort of left field macro type things come up and, you know, you decide to go diving deep into that?
Exactly. Well, we still love the businesses that we own. You know, we had a great year last year with the virus, and, you know, we bought in and we did well. You know, I think the year was like 120% up. Whereas this year, I think we're down about 30 at the moment, because we're very concentrated. We only own 6 stocks. And I think that's probably...
And none of them are in bubbles. Okay with that. Like, all the best investors in history have done worse compared to the market during a bubble. Yeah, so yeah. That's a good point for me.
We just wake up every morning and just repeat that over and over again. The best investors do worse in bubbles.
Don't look at the MTA. Yeah.
But
just quickly, that reminds me of, I think Munger said something along the lines, talking about the 2008-2009 crisis.
Yeah.
I think he said something to the effect of, if you weren't down 70%, then you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah,
so, yeah.
Exactly. And trying to buy things that, you know, are having some kind of uncertainty or are having an issue, because we're value investors. Sure. We like buying things that are cheap and that are going to improve over time, or that have some, you know, issue. And yeah, we're long-term investors, so we're okay with the volatility. Like, you know, that's just all part of trying to outperform, is accepting that. So we're not tempted this time to sell everything, because in an inflationary environment, stocks can have the potential to do well still, surprisingly, because they can raise prices to match that inflation. I think I said on our podcast, the example, you know, if you own a stock at 10 times earnings and that stock can raise prices at 5% per year and retain its margin and keep growing its profit with inflation, you know, and you've only paid a low multiple of earnings, you should be okay. You probably won't lose money. So yeah, as far as from a portfolio point of view, we're not selling everything or anything like that. We're just, it's more of a, I guess, a bet towards the fact that this could happen. And, you know, we put it between 50 and 70% roughly, that the inflation is not transitory. It may be getting out of control and they may have to take action quickly to raise those rates. But like you said, it's something that we, you know, I'm pretty sure it's on the whiteboard. It's like, don't think that just because it worked once for us, it's going to work again. Mm-hmm. It's very much risk specific. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I call it like a classic Dando bet, probably.
Yeah.
Where it's like, you know, heads you win, tails you don't lose much.
Yeah.
Which is what the pricing of our options kind of fits in.
Yeah, that's how it feels. Yeah.
Yeah, cool. So talk me through how have you gone about expressing this, you know, view on inflation and potentially interest rates having to follow? How have you gone about expressing that view as a portfolio position?
Exactly. Yeah. So if you look back at, you know, Buffett's letters, the main thing he talks about and makes kind of mathematical sense is you don't want to own bonds, because bonds are a fixed payment for a set amount of time. So if you can imagine, you know, if you're getting $2 per year in cash flow and you've paid $100 for your bond, you're making 2%. That's happening no matter what. There's no pricing power in a bond. There's nothing like that. You know, the $2 is your 2%. Now, if interest rates go up to a point where that's not so competitive a return anymore, well, the face value of your bond has to come down for the next person to get a more adequate return. So, you know, 2% per year, that might have felt pretty good a few years ago. But if we're getting inflation right now, 6.8%, and for most people who don't have an incentive seem to think, you know, around 4% might be a level, 3.5%, and you've got rates moving up to that kind of level, well, that means that the face value of that bond has to decline, you know. So we've decided that the best way to insure ourselves and potentially short this is to short bond ETFs. So there's a number of bond ETFs, I think maybe 20 or 30 on the market, different kinds of bonds, you know, higher quality, lower quality, different durations in the portfolio. So some have, you know, 4 years of duration. Yeah, that means that the average bond in the portfolio, you know, is only a 4 year term. And our biggest, you know, shorted position is something called HYG. Obviously, I'm saying specifics now, so do your own research. And, you know, knowing about options, you do lose your whole premium. Think of it like insurance, you know, on a car. You know, if nothing happens to your car, you have lost your car insurance, but you're protected. So yeah, we've bought options that if the bond ETF was to say fall by 50%, then the option would pay off between 50 and 60x essentially, because bonds are very non-volatile, that they haven't moved much in history. And the way option pricing works is that if a security is not volatile, then the premium or the cost of insuring against that security is quite cheap, which is why they made so much money in The Big Short. So because Mike Burry and because those investors were betting on, you know, a security that had never gone bad, that had never gone down, mortgage-backed securities, that's why the payoff was so great. You know, but just like Mike Burry in that, you know, on that whiteboard writing those negative red numbers, you know, you can easily start chewing through capital. So yeah, where we own about 5% of our NTA, 5% of our portfolio is now, you know, invested in these put options on two different bond ETFs. One's a corporate bond ETF called LQD, and one's a high yield bond ETF called HYG.
Mm-hmm. And so how do you think about sizing these things? And I mean, is that 5% bit kind of a mix of different durations and expiry dates on these put options? What have you put in place?
Exactly. There? Yeah. So at the moment, we've decided that 6 months is the minimum that we want to give this. So that would be the assumption that at some point between March, April, May, in that time frame, the market either realizes that they're going to have to raise rates to stop this, or the Fed comes out and says, look, inflation is now our priority and we want to slow this economy down. And that will be the catalyst to people to accept that this is a problem in reality that has to be dealt with. But that could, there's when you're dealing with the Federal Reserve, and you know, we've even been researching whether they would bail out these bond ETFs in a situation, which is all possible. Like, there's no guarantee that this would happen, but it seems to me quite unlikely that if they're trying to tighten the economy and trying to restrict the economy, they would then go in and bail out a high yield bond ETF with AMC in it, you know, as one of the bonds. You know, like, it's not, these aren't high quality, high employment companies. This is essentially companies on their knees, on the verge of bankruptcy. And the actual return people are accepting right now for owning that high yield bond ETF is 4.3%. So that's just the kind of, you know, if you can imagine how appealing that high yield debt is, if you're only getting 4.3% in an environment where you could perhaps get 3% in the bank, well, the price has to come down to give you that return. So hopefully that wasn't too much info, but that's basically what we're doing.
Yeah, makes sense. And I guess presumably, like, I'm trying to think of this from the, because I don't have a huge amount of experience with bonds, but I do sort of keep an eye on what you know, Buffett at Berkshire's kind of up to. So they have a lot of their cash sitting in short-term government bonds, I think, for example.
Yes.
I guess one of the reasons for that is because if he were to buy a long bond, like a 30-year bond, like you say, if he needs that cash to go and buy stocks, that value can fly around all over the place, right? So
exactly.
Yeah. Are you trying to, so I think it was it HYG you said was the,
yes,
the high yield bond index. So is that filled with sort of like longer duration bonds generally, or is it a mix of things, or how do you think about
those? Yeah, so the average bonds? It's a mix of everything, but the average duration is four years in that ETF. Right. And then our other ETF, the average duration is 10 years. So that could be the length of the inflationary period, but it's very much like a finger in the air sort of approach from that point with us. It's like, well, I understand that bonds are going to be affected negatively. I understand that inflation's bad for it. And as far as the duration stuff, if there's any bond experts out there who want to, you know, give me a DM and say like, well, you're way off on this, you have a different duration. But from what I can tell, if you're going to be essentially being paid money for a 4-year period, and if we're going through a 4-year inflationary period, then that's kind of going to be negatively affected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool. And so I guess once you've got this position on, I mean, again, I'm kind of coming at this from the angle of having not done a lot of this before, but you know, obviously invested in individual companies before, and I have sort of like a, you know, obviously an underlying thesis when I buy into a company, right? And there's key metrics that I can kind of keep an eye on over time to, you know, monitor that I think it's working out generally in the direction that I'd hoped would happen. What's that process look like for a bet like this? Is it, you know, I know there's a lot of contention around whether the CPI is even a reasonable measure of inflation, and you know, is it that you're keeping an eye on? Are there other stuff that you're, things that you're watching? Like, how do you know if you're right or wrong, and how do you monitor these things?
That's probably where it's kind of like more intuitive than a lot of value investors would like, because it is not really a calculation that you can plug into a computer. Like, it's you've got to stay current with news, stay current with what the Fed's talking about. You've got to look at CPI, but you've actually got to dig into it and see where it could be inaccurate. You've got to like watch news broadcasts of like the average American people and try and understand what they're experiencing. Because a lot of the time, like, we can make moves before the Fed can. Like, we have that freedom to, like, if we see it a different way and we're sure enough in that, then we can make our moves earlier. Like,
Does that make sense?
That
makes sense. But I think what we're pretty much doing is we're reading everything on inflation that comes out. So everything that's coming out, because one thing I guess the similarity that it is with the virus, or the similarity I'm feeling, just again, it's just my opinion, just my intuitive sense of it, is that there's a slow realization that this is going to happen or could happen, and people start out coming out like, if I could go back and find every clip of every virus expert that was on, you know, CNBC saying this is nothing to worry about. I mean, me and Cass were just like screaming at the computer over and over again, saying like, you know, you don't understand, like, you're not focusing on the data here. So definitely watching the data, watching the reality of actually how bad the inflation is, what the causes seem to be. It's definitely becoming more about, less about a lack of supply and more about wage inflation. They're even having a resurgence in America of, you know, employees trying to unionize, which pushes pushes wages up. That pushes the costs, you know, to companies up, and then they raise prices. The rate, the, you know, the prices that have risen come back to consumers as, you know, as costs in their, you know, average budget, and that can then lead more to more price increases. So, to the extent that, that it's called a wage price spiral, to the extent that the wage price spiral continues, or, you know, gains momentum, that would prove that inflation is happening. Now, we could be in a situation where inflation could be raging, but the Fed might maintain to do nothing. And we're pretty happy with how things are going on that front too, because the Federal Reserve has actually changed drastically what they were saying from, a, you know, three months ago. So 3 months ago, they were saying, we believe it's transitory. Their forecast for inflation for this year was 2.1%, ended up being 6.8%. So they were quite far off. They have a forecast for what inflation will be next year, which is quite low. And because their forecast for inflation is quite low, they've said to the market, we're only going to have to raise rates 3 times. Now, that's great if that happens, if their inflation just kind of peters out normal and they only have to raise rates 3 times. But, you know, when you look at people like Larry Summers, I think he tweeted out this morning that, you know, inflation just normalizing by itself without having to cause a recession or tightening is almost without precedent in history. So what investors are betting on essentially is that something that's never happened in history before, which is inflation just magically normalizing of itself, people just, you know, calming down, they're not, you know, watching assets go up anymore, they're just happy to just let it peter out is what's going to happen. And that means that they don't have to raise rates. And that just feels really unlikely to me. And as we keep watching the situation, the Fed's now moved from saying no interest rate hikes a few months ago to three this year, and they meet every month. So every month you get an update of what they're, how they're seeing the economy. And as long as they keep, okay, well, maybe next meeting it'll be four interest rate hikes, and then maybe next one will be five, and they kind of break it slowly to the market. You know, it's kind of like a, I don't know, they don't want to give you all the bad news at once. But that's sort of, I guess, how we're monitoring it. But you're right, Tom, it is a very different sort of mindset to just understanding a business, buying that business, and then just making sure it's not going off track. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think Cass, earlier you described this whole thing as like this quite complex sort of ecosystem where there's various different components moving in different directions. And I imagine there probably are some parts of this equation that, you know, clearly probably aren't going to be transitory. Like if people are having higher wages, that's quite a difficult cost to sort of pull back down again, like when people get comfortable with a certain level of income.
I don't know about
so
you, like if you've ever been paid an hourly amount and your employer is like, all right, we're going to pay you $5 less per hour now. Like, has that ever happened?
It's not going to go down well. But there must be parts of it though, like, you know, supply chain and so on, that sure might take a year, maybe even in some cases, to sort of iron out some issues there. But presumably some prices, you know, should be coming back to earth.
Yeah, I think the main concern is probably the energy in like price increases.
Yeah.
Especially coming into like a cold season for American families.
Yeah.
I think energy went up 56% or something.
Yeah, fuel's up around 50%. And that's, the government doesn't have really much control over a lot of those things. So a lot of the prices, I heard it described the other day, it's like America, it's a big country, but it's kind of like it's a small country in the sense that a lot of the things people that make up the people's budgets come from overseas, and the causes of the inflation are in those other countries. They're not actually in America. So it's very hard to address them. The only way to address it is to put a dampener on demand, which is what interest rates do. You know, it makes it more attractive to save in the bank. It makes it less attractive to borrow. It makes it so that it has all these effects, whereas people often, I think, see it just from the market point of view, basically. Like, you know, they shouldn't do this because it would be bad for the stock market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool. And I guess, you know, if we fast forward a little bit here and let's say, you know, let's say this does sort of all play out and we're 6 or 12 months down the track. I mean, how do you see that sort of impacting like your broader portfolio? Because, you know, in the grand scheme of the portfolio, this is, I think you mentioned, a 5% bet, but you've still got, you know, you're at least probably pretty close to fully invested, I would think, outside of that.
Yeah, about 85% invested,
Okay, yeah. So I mean, how do you think of this like inflationary backdrop with your other kind of core portfolio positions? Like, I think from memory, you have maybe some real estate investments. I think Howard Hughes, I'm not sure if you're still invested there, but I mean, that's probably likely to have elements of sort of inflation protection built in, but I don't know if there's other businesses that you own that don't. How do you think through that?
Yeah, Cass brought that up on our morning walk 2 days ago. She was like, you know, I think Howard Hughes is really our most in danger position from that, because they do make, they make money two ways, from selling land and also from, you know, building buildings that then they rent out. All their rents are indexed to CPI, and their buildings are, you know, good quality buildings and good locations. So they would preserve value, but there would be a lot of other negative factors to having to raise the price of debt. And perhaps they wouldn't be able to pass all that on. So yeah, you're right. We are starting to consider things like that, but we also want it to be like a true hedge. So we want it to be like, if this doesn't happen and, you know, the inflation, you know, for the first time in economic history, just kind of like peters out by itself, we're happy to lose, you know, 2.5% to 5%, because we can obviously sell out at any time. So we're happy to lose that money if we're protected. And it's very much like a, if you put a 50x on a 5% position, you know, it kind of solves all of your other problems in a sense.
Yeah,
so
you'll be fine.
Frank asked me the same question and I said, yeah, that's a good question, but I'll cross that lovely bridge when I come to it, you know?
Yeah.
Basically, I think we feel like everything we hold, it's not going to go bankrupt. Like
yes.
It's not going to just fall to being worthless.
True.
It could go down in value, it could halve in value again, but
yeah.
We're happy to wait that out, you know, as long as it takes. I mean, it could be like a decade of everything going nowhere, possibly, if the future plays out with inflation how we think it might. But yeah, that's just playing the long game.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in sort of the vehicle you chose to do this with the high yield bond index. Mm-hmm. You know, traditional inflation hedges, people just kind of dive into commodities and gold miners or maybe precious metals straight up, or maybe there's even some crypto bros out there saying that that's the best option. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Any thoughts on crypto?
Well, I mean, more conventional kind of, you know, inflation hedges like gold miners, commodities and so on.
Yeah. Like gold, for example, we bought some gold in the last coronavirus pandemic and the gold was going down just as fast as everything else. It was just a sea of red as people are trying to liquidate anything they've got to pay margin calls and everything. So gold's one of these things that if you did have one of these crazy scenarios, you hear Robert Kiyosaki talk about where there's, you know, currency devaluation and, you know, the world order needs to be upended and, you know, gold becomes a new reserve currency, then gold would be the way to go. But that's like so many levels down away from, you know, what we're facing. Most of those options, you would need to move a huge amount of capital to actually offset any losses from, you know, multiple compression and the negative effects of inflation in your portfolio. So that would involve me probably, you know, I guess us allocating 20 or 30% at minimum to a bunch of other assets that are more your typical kind of inflationary investments, you know, miners, those kind of things. So I think I like the ability to hold our current stocks and have that payoff leverage. And also, you know, being short the worst debt in the economy is kind of feels good to me. Like it feels good that if the economy was to be in trouble and turn down, there would be a lot of you know, downside to the payments coming from those highly levered companies having to have new interest rates. So not only do you get the fact that it's less appealing to buy a high yield bond ETF, you also could be, you know, getting default risk, although at least the fear of default risk would be the main reason. So it is kind of unorthodox. I found out afterwards that, yeah, Mike Burry did have a position like this. He had several positions that a few months ago. I'm not sure whether he's transferred them to things you can't see. Like I know it's quite hard with those investor 10Q, I think it's called, or whatever it is in America, to see what people own. But yeah, I found that after I did the bond ETF that he was actually short other bond ETFs. So I think we're on the right track.
Yeah, I think like when there's an opportunity like this present itself, like living in such a historically abnormal time, you want to harness that opportunity in like with the best return you could possibly get in a calculated way.
Yeah.
That's probably why we've gone with that instead of just buying gold and commodities or uranium. I mean, I think if our option plays out, then we'll use that cash to put it into more secure long-term holds like those through a rocky inflationary period for a decade to come. That's probably the rough plan, but who knows what's actually going to happen. Like it could be a totally different story next year.
And the draw card is that the Federal Reserve is, you know, that what they can do is they can print money and they can keep buying assets that get in trouble, and they can keep doing that for, you know, a long time. But at some point they have to tighten the financial system and to reduce demand and try and normalize things. So I think it's a good question, and there perhaps are other investments that other people could do. I had an option, a call option on a gold miner, for example. So, you know, that was only a 1% position, but I calculated that, you know, the profit increase of the gold miner, if the gold price did rise would then make that option a 20x or a 30x. So you get that kind of like insurance like payoff, where it's a small cost, it's a drag on your portfolio, but then if there is an issue, it goes bang and it offsets and hopefully gives you capital at the right time. Yeah,
gotcha. So you're sort of thinking through it. You've gone down the puts on the high yield bond index because you see it, you know, it's a small position. If it doesn't play out, that position effectively goes to zero.
Yeah.
But if it does play out, it's a huge home run multi-bagger, and you think the odds are far better than a coin flip, right? So definitely. It's attractive to you in that respect.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, you've got several very experienced economists who aren't in the government, which actually to me makes them more objective. They're not in the government. They can say whatever they want. And saying that, you know, inflation hasn't been normalized without a recession in most cases. So we've got inflation, we've got what the solution is. And yeah, it feels like a coin flip to me, at least a coin flip. And on one side of that coin, you've got a 50X. On the other side, you've got a 5% loss. So yeah, it's very much a monish bet in that way.
I think so. Yeah. And it might not even be the total 5% loss, because we kind of have a strategy where you check in like 50% through the duration of the option term.
Yeah.
And it slowly loses its value. So you can sell it out at a value and then renew it for like a different period to like extend the lifespan.
Exactly.
So yeah, it doesn't even have to be a total loss.
Yeah.
If you just, does that make sense?
Yeah, makes sense. Exactly. It may not be a total loss, but we're happy for it to be. Yeah.
Yeah, cool. Why don't you think more value investors look at these things?
That's a good question.
It's kind of scary. Like, I don't know.
I'd say that, like, losing money, being positive that you're going to lose money if you're not right, is quite confronting, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just lucky that like Mitch logs in and actually makes the purchases of the options. Because like for me, I'm like, yeah, that makes sense. Okay, yeah, I back this. I don't know if I could actually log on to the computer and be like, buy.
Right. You know, like execute.
That might be too difficult. I don't know.
I think you could.
Putting your money where your mouth is when you've got to be a bit of a contrarian. It's never easy to do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think people have just been reading Buffett too long, who's, you know, for the most part, just buy great businesses and micro over macro, kind of forget the rest?
Yeah, that's a really hard question. I think that the human nature is that you, especially when it comes to money, is you want to be safe and secure. And it really is hard going out on your own and having no one agree with you and you know, potentially just smart people who sound smart, you know, disagreeing with you. Like, it's very, that Buffett spoke about that is the most challenging part of investing. So I guess I've been doing it for 8 years and now it's gotten easier and easier and easier to just back myself and to back ourselves. And now Cass, obviously, I think her knowledge is probably 95% of my investing knowledge. You would disagree with that, but I think that it is.
105, Mitch.
They're like 20% I'd be happy with.
No. Yeah. Cass has only been doing it for a few years. But yeah, it's, her knowledge is incredible. So the questions she asks me and the discussions that we have around worst case scenarios and if this happened, what we'd do with this situation, like, you know, I very much got someone I can bounce a lot of great ideas off. And that we do a lot of stress testing of things and seeing, you know, how would we feel if we were down this much and yeah, having that other person with me to sort of bounce things off is, I think, what gives me a lot of confidence. But yeah, there's that. Like you said, it's hard to do something different that no one's done before. And I'm fortunate, both I guess fortunate and not so fortunate, that I've had something happen before that worked out well, because that has its own possible negatives. If, you know, you could easily start, like you said last time we talked to you, you know, you just start doing these things all the time, hoping for that big payoff.
Yeah, I think I brought up last time, you know, we've seen some of the people, I keep bringing up The Big Short here, but we've seen some of the people that were like stars in The Big Short sort of fall into that trap if they have one big win, in this case, you know, the financial crisis in 2008, and then they're sort of constant like doomsdayers and that I guess they're having these hedges constantly kind of eat away at the portfolio, and you know, maybe from time to time they pay off really well, but other times they don't. How do you think about that?
I think that we've only done this once before with the virus, and I do trust like my intuition with these things to a certain extent. And I think we all us value investors, all us people who like want to see an actual cash flow when we're buying something, you know, all of us look at all of these things, your Teslas and your Dogecoins and property prices and classic cars and art. And, you know, you see these things and you're like, oh, this is crazy. And it's crazy because it's a unique time in history. Like it's actually, this time actually is different. And when you are being bombarded by these kind of things, like we went to the hairdressers 2 weeks ago and she was talking about how her husband, who's a project manager, is going to potentially quit his job next year to do trading. I'm like, oh, wow, he must be doing investing for a long time. And yes, she said, oh, no, he's been, you know, he's made so much money off crypto coins and all this kind of stuff. And both me and Cass are sitting there going, like making these faces, because you just know that this is when the average person is getting involved in this kind of thing. And all our friends, you know, they're asking us, you know, what do you think of this? What do you think of that? Like, we've done a pretty good, I think, amount of work on crypto generally. And I haven't yet, unlike the internet where you could, when it was booming, you could see it being used. People would get in the internet. They were buying things on the internet. I'm still not seeing any uses of it in real life that would make me think that this is a trend that's gaining momentum in the real world. It seems like just one big speculative bubble. So all of these things, noticing all these things, have definitely influenced me to say like, okay, yeah, it's not good to have a drag on performance hedging, but this is a symptom of too much money in the system. Too much money in the system is causing inflation, and that's what's made us do this. So I guess we'll see what happens. But yeah, I think that it's a crazy time to be alive. And there is, like Cass said, there's bubbles everywhere.
And I guess that's why we only do like a 5% position, because it's like, well, if we do five of them, only one has to turn out, and then you've more than made up for you.
Yeah.
You know, what you've spent. And yeah, when the signals, when you actually can see they are signals and not just noise.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, we have to do something. Like, you have to do something.
You have to do something.
Look at the world we're living in. Like,
Yeah.
Cool. Do you think doing this as a couple helps you kind of behave a bit more rationally than if you're doing this solo?
It might just make us more confident than we should be. But
I don't think so. We're so happy to say we're wrong, and like, honestly, I hope we turn out to be wrong, because it's going to be quite the correction in the market for a lot of people, and a lot of pain that, you know, normal citizens have to go through in times like this. So we're not happy if we're right.
No, we're not at all.
I think it helps to have someone to constantly bounce ideas off and put our pressure test our ideas, because
I think that pressure testing is right. I think both of us, we have the kind of relationship that we have where we are happy to ask the person difficult questions, and I'm also always comfortable just saying, I don't know the answer to that question, and that really helps. So I feel like it does make it a lot easier. I know I've become a much better investor and a much better communicator of investing as well, having to explain some of these concepts. Like, you know what it's like when you've got an idea in your head, and you do understand pretty much what you're saying, but then when you have to actually explain it to somebody who's like really intelligent, who's going to ask you challenging questions about it, that's when you really, really get your research correct, especially if it's half of her money. So I think overall it's been a positive, definitely.
But it just kind of motivates you, because you're just trying to find the truth. Like the truth is going to ultimately help you better than floating on some crazy idea that you've got that you're just biasing yourself into thinking is correct.
Yeah.
Like, we just are trying to find truth. And I think when you've got two people with their own perspectives and their own circles of knowledge coming at it and feeling okay to be like, that doesn't make sense. How do you know that? Like open questioning, open communication. I think it's a pretty unique combination. Like, I don't know any other couples who are really doing this intricately together.
No, I don't know.
Have you heard of any, Tom?
Yeah, I've seen a few couples on YouTube. I'm blanking on the names, but it's not common, really. It's like not usually common, one person cares about the stuff a lot more than the other person. Or
yeah, well, it's really cool when you've got two people.
It's a cool dynamic. Yeah.
Like, we're always talking about stuff like 24 hours a day. Like, we'll wake up in the middle of the night and be like, oh, well, I just had this idea. You know, like, it really does use your energy. Like, it pushes you to the limit. But and it's good.
I was going to say, too, like, you might think that if you don't have a job, then you'll, you know, be a lot more relaxed in your life. But actually, it can. We've had it go the opposite way many times. But because we've wanted to get something done so much, or we've been so excited about something, we've worked ourselves way harder than we ever did for any employer. Yeah. Which is actually the danger, because you don't want to burn yourself out. Because at the end of the day, we're trying to make quality decisions, and if you don't make a quality decision, then you know you're going to lose your money, you're going to make mistakes. So you don't want to push too hard. But yeah, we can easily get very chatty, can't we?
Yeah.
you guys will be like the nerdy friends talking about finance and inflation when you go out with your mates, right?
Yeah.
It is hard. It is hard not to, you know, sort of chew everyone's ear off about inflation constantly, but it's, you know, we're done too bad. We've still got friends.
Yeah, most people know not to go out to dinner with us because it's just it's too boring, or way too intense. We need more nerdy friends, maybe.
Maybe that's what it is. Yeah.
I'll come visit you guys one day when these borders are a bit easier to get back and forth.
We'll come
between.
To you.
Yeah, you're in New Zealand. Yeah, so why would you come to Brisbane? That's terrible.
Okay. I was just trying to escape after all these lockdowns. But yeah, I can. You guys can come here. Let's do that. Good. All good. Well, I think just one final sort of section to wrap this episode up. I put a community post up on YouTube last night, asking people for their burning inflation questions. So I might put a few of those to you guys, and you can let us know your thoughts. So yeah, that's a bit of a big one. So a question from Alex: have central bankers completely lost control?
Not yet.
You've got a definitive answer to that one, have you?
I don't know. Maybe we should talk about it first and then decide. But I don't think yet. I think if they rose rates quickly, you know, and they really got in front of it, they made it an issue, there's a number of other things they can do to slow the economy down. If they took it seriously, then they're not losing control. But if they continue to taper, which is tapering is still pushing money into the system, they're still pushing fresh money in the system, and they don't raise rates fast, and the, you know, inflation gets to 10%, then there's a lot of precedents in history where central banks have lost control. And so you don't want to be getting close to that. You want to be erring on the side of controlling it more than allowing it to run. But yeah, I don't know, maybe.
I just think the word control is quite hilarious. Like, I don't think they're actually ever in control of anything. They're just like, people have the idea that they're in control, or they'd have the idea that they're not in control, but they're just reacting to what's happening in real time. So...
And we saw that when we did our kind of study of interest rates. Like, it's inflation that leads interest rates, not the other way around. Mm. So that they see inflation, they come in, they raise rates. That's they're reacting. They're doing their best. I'm not a conspiracy theorist on this stuff. I believe that they're doing their best. You know, we think that they're doing what seems to be the course of least harm. But often harm can be building where you don't see it. Which is what really worries me. And the constant chatter, they're always always reference the stock market, which is not in their job description, really. Obviously, markets crashing are bad for people's retirement savings, and that can have a wealth effect of a sort, I suppose. But yeah, it's they need to really make sure the average person's, you know, wage is not less than the growth in inflation, because people get pretty dejected pretty quick in that kind of economy.
Yeah, I guess the way I would answer that is I think they're risking people seeing them as not in control.
Yes.
Very soon.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's an important distinction you made just there around sort of, I guess it's like the chicken and the egg kind of situation, mm-hmm. between inflation and interest rates. I think a lot of people kind of have the view that the Fed moves interest rates around and that has a flow-on effect to inflation, but it's the reverse. Is that that's how you view it?
Yeah. When looking back at the way interest rates move, yeah, it was the inflation rate that goes first and then the rate comes behind it. And through the 70s, from memory, they had three large surges of inflation where they raised rates right up to the point of inflation. So inflation went spiked, let's say it was 7%. They raised to 7%, inflation came down. And then a year or two later, bang, inflation's back up again to 12%. They raised rates to, let's say it was 12%, inflation comes down. And the last time when Volcker, he raised rates past inflation. So rates got to 20% and inflation was around 15% or 16%. So he actually, if you can imagine that kind of situation, we're now at 6.8, that would be a rate rise of towards 10 to make people stop spending, stop buying used cars at high prices, stop buying Bitcoin, stop doing all these things, calm down, reduce the demand so we can get ourselves off this kind of merry-go-round of, I don't know what you would call it, but...
Yeah, but the spending happens first.
Yeah.
And the Fed is like, okay, this is how people are spending. This is how we want them to spend. How can we make that happen?
Exactly.
So yeah, they're just kind of, you know, looking after a kindergarten, basically. Looking after children. It's like,
yeah.
Yeah. It's a tough job. I wouldn't want to do it.
It's a hard job. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure they're well paid though. All right, let's maybe take one more. So I may have to reword this question slightly, but this is from Ali Mad. Sorry if I'm butchering that name. So the question basically is, I know you guys have obviously taken the high yield bond kind of route here, but is there any sort of general correlation between inflation and the performance of different asset classes? Are there asset classes that, I guess, quote, typically do well in periods of high inflation and other asset classes that sort of typically do poorly? Or is it a little kind of all over the place? I think
that's where a little bit nuanced in a way, because they say, well, stocks are good to be in. Companies are good to own, but it really depends on the company. Like some companies will do worse during inflation and some will do better.
Companies that are highly levered would obviously do worse, especially if they're in a industry where they don't have pricing power.
Yeah. So you've got to really pick which companies, not just be like, all right, I'll move to stocks, because generally, you know, it's not just all stocks that do well. It's specific industries and sectors. I think commodities generally always do well. I mean, you just kind of go back to the basics of what do people need? Like, what are they going to spend their money on because they have to, because they need it to survive?
Yeah.
I think that those industries generally do well.
Definitely. That's the kind of dynamic that you would be looking for. But yeah, we've done a bit of work on it, but yeah, I'd let people do their own research on that one. And you always have the temptation that we've done it too with this. You know, you look back at history and you look back and you say, well, that's what worked last time. But often it's not what's going to work this time. Like I know Mike Burry, I believe he owns Facebook and a few others. And I was like, oh, I wonder why Facebook. We own Facebook too. And when I actually looked at it is, yeah, that would make sense. You know, higher advertising spend, they've got a pretty controllable cost base in that business. So you're going to get operating leverage. You're going to get, you know, higher value of dollars going through there as inflation kicks off. That would be a, you know, from our estimates, a pretty solid investment. Yeah.
Cool. I like it. Well, I think that's a nice place to wrap it up. I really appreciate you guys' time. It's always good talking to you. We may have to get you back on the podcast again in a year's time or something and see how all this worked out.
Do an annual
update. Yeah. Book you in for 18th of December each year. And then we'll go from there.
We'll see.
No, look, I think it's a really good discussion topic nonetheless, because there's a lot of headlines about inflation, but I don't think there's a lot of nuanced thought about how to actually put intelligent hedges in place. So I think this was a good discussion. I mean, for anyone, just to wrap this up, for anyone that's maybe not following along with what you guys are doing already, I know you're both on Twitter and you have a podcast as well. So do you want to plug that quickly or anywhere else people can go to hear more from you?
Yeah, so just Mitch, M-I-T-C-H underscore Doll, D-O-L on Twitter, and yours is Cassia underscore Doll?
Yep, so mine's K-A-S-S-I-A underscore D-O-L, and our podcast is Buffeting.
buffeting. Yep, with Cass and Mitch. We don't do it probably as regularly as we should, but we try and wait until we have something good. We talk about the COVID investment. We talked about a bit more about our history, and I guess I'd imagine we'll be doing them a lot more with the more.
Yeah, we'll try to get more regular. We're not as good as you, Tom.
No, well, you guys are much better than me, and like you don't seem to feel the pressure about having to put regular content out. You wait until you got something intelligent to say, which is probably the way to go.
We're not into commitment. Well, we're with each other. We don't like to commit to anything in the future.
locking ourselves in and feeling like a job, but there is a lot of value in doing it regularly. I think, and it's been so good to look back on and hear us, communicating things and listen back, and it's very good for you to do. So hopefully we'll keep a bit more regular from now on.
Yeah, for sure. All right, I appreciate your time. We'll have to do this again one day soon.
Definitely.
Awesome. Thanks, Tom. Great chat.
All right. Cheers. Thanks, guys.